boys at this stage, or anyone at this stage, to learn some of the halachas we're learning and the style in which it's described, and to find it a little bit foreign and different from our value system, from our society, and not just different, but in some ways abrasive. And I want to step you through it because there are many, many issues here that I want you to face with both sophistication and piety, and I want to make sure that you're able to calibrate the right tone. It's really important as part of building yourself as Ovdei Hashem. But before I start, the preface. If you find them abrasive and you find yourself morally indignant, Baruch Hashem, that's a good sign. That shows that you're morally aware, morally sensitive, morally passionate. And to a degree, one can claim that if you read things like this or of this nature and there's no moral response, then maybe you're morally callous. Maybe. And some people would be like, who cares? So the fact that these ideas or thoughts are registering in your emotions is important, and it's important to ratify them and validate them. And they can find a place that coexists with piety and with intellectual subtlety, but don't suppress them. Don't be afraid if they're coming up. That just shows that when you read about the punishment for a rapist being 50 zuz, or punishment being a marrier's whole life, that doesn't jive with our current state of marriage and sexuality and how we view rape, and how is that a punishment? We throw the person in prison. We lock the key. We throw away the key. Throw away the key. Okay, you're in prison. I'm locking you up. Here's the key. All right, throw away the key. Right? Thank you. We throw away the key. And when we read about a father selling his daughter, or selling his daughter, or when we read about the din of Yibum and that it could be Bal Karchach, so these are areas that don't naturally drive with our world and the standards of morality in our world. So if you feel like, where does this come from? It's just fix the Rambam, I need the Rambam anyway. Is that yours or mine? Right. Where does this come from? It's a perfectly natural response. Now, what are the dangers? What are the traps that I want you to avoid, and how do you resolve these? Okay, and these are traps that you'll face in many, 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 many areas of life, not just in religion, but in views, in politics, in morality, in world discussions. And in particular, we'll talk about how to view this in the world of Chazal, or for that matter, in the Torah, right? There are certain parts of Chazal, but Yavam, Yibam, Balkarcha, Zedin, Menat Torah. And Mechiras Hama, Zedin, Menat Torah. Mechiras Bito, Bekidushin, or Mekadosh, Bito, Akhtana. It's a din in the Torah. So how do you face these? So I want to talk about three different areas. Number one, intellectual humility, intellectual honesty about systems, about ideas, not just about cultures, but about ideas. Number two is when you try to bring your values to other cultures, what are the dangers there? Cultural appropriation or cultural transfer, cultural export and import. And then finally, how do we view the world of Chazal? It's just Chazal on their own, because the first two are how to deal with other cultures. How do you deal with cultures you've never met? How do you deal with people you've never met? Generations you've never met? How to deal with systems, okay? These are the traps that normally very, very smart people fall into. It's very smart people are analytical. Very smart people have strongly held opinions. Sometimes people that aren't as smart don't generate those opinions, and they're more accepting, okay? And Mirtz Hashem, I hope that one of the takeaways you'll take from this year is sometimes intelligence is a handicap. Sometimes too much is not good. Sometimes a little. So like everything in life, every trait Hashem gives you has its positive applications and its traps. Okay, so don't think that anything is, oh, I'm this or I'm that. What are the traps I face because I'm smart? If I'm not smart, I don't have those traps. Like everything has to be really, really carefully thought of without these simplistic, one-dimensional, everything is its danger. Okay, number one. The first issue is intellectual humility. Okay, is not making random, large-scale, sweeping statements, characteristic statements before you've read the entire work, the entire system, the entire platform. The biggest mistakes, the biggest crimes of demagoguery when it's intentional, and intellectual humiliation when it's unintentional, is you pick out one idea and you blow it up as representative of an entire system you know nothing about. That's when you can tell the people just talking through their, you know, blowing hot air, they don't know what they're talking about, just pick one idea. Be careful about that. Now, obviously, sometimes there are ideas that are so bizarre and so antithetical to what we believe in that you don't have to read the whole system. So if someone just reads Parshas Kitetze and sees genocide, that's a question. You don't have to read the rest of the Torah to know, well, how does this fit with other aspects and what's the overall network of logic on display if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us to kill an entire nation, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avram to kill his son Yitzchak, that creates a lot of moral questions, as it should. Just because you have moral questions doesn't mean you shouldn't follow Hashem's command. Part of Avodas Hashem is the ability to put human morality aside in terms of execution, not in terms of thought and deliberation, but Hashem gives you a mitzvah, you mekayim the mitzvah. But something that's a lot more complicated, and a lot more subtle, such as the laws of sexuality and marriage, and there, if you told me, look, I studied all the laws, and I know them well, and I put them together, I understand their logic, even though it's not a cultural question, it's systemic. Are you seeing something panoramically? You're just looking at... So just be careful. You're starting to learn. If you want to learn all of Kiddushin and all of Yevamos, or at least significant enough, and think about them, and process them, and what does it mean, and become a little more informed, sometimes the greatest moments of humiliation are when people... A little bit of knowledge is very, very dangerous. They'll just pick out one statement out of context. It's a question of context and seeing. Again, I can't tell you the balance between how much you need to know in order to make an intelligent statement, but I see a lot of people knowing nothing about anything. They'll just pick out one statement they believe they've achieved and just... Now, you know, you could say the following. The following statement would be legitimate. I haven't really studied all the halachos, or all the areas of this system. But to me, it seems like this is something I'd have to think about a little more. That would be an intellectually honest way. Generally, intellectual honesty and intellectual humility go hand in hand. People that are honest enough, they know their limitations, they know how much they've studied, they know what they haven't been exposed to. They say, I haven't really read that much, but it seems to me this is something that could cause problems. Rather than these blanket, overarching, bombastic statements, this, it tends to be a chisaron. And again, when I say intellectual honesty is not just an intellectual value. It is a moral value. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is emes. And we are trying as much as we can to be anshei emes. And if we want to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we want to try to have that midah of emes. And we don't live in a world of emes because we're all partly emes, partly sheker. But the degree to which we're intellectually honest means the degree, or it's an indicator of how close we are to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you're asking me for one of the hallmarks of Talmidim of Rav Aharon, if you ask me to profile, like how I'm able to smell out a real Talmid of Rav Aharon, it's intellectual honesty. And it's intellectual honesty not just to succeed in college or to be able to be on it. Intellectual honesty because you see that as a midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you want to have that midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So intellectual honesty means you just have to learn a little bit more until you can render statements that are a little bit more informed. So that's not about different cultures, it's not about Chazal, it's about politics, it's about any idea that you will encounter in this world. Don't just dismiss it hastily and impetuously and emphatically and passionately. I know you're in the age of passion. The age of 18 through 25 is the age of passion. And it's important to feel passionate. But you have to find a way to wield your passion along with intellectual honesty, intellectual humility. So that's one area I want you to think about. How much have you learned? And again, if it's a statement that's black and white, genocide, again, we can talk about Amalek, we can talk about Akedas Yitzchak, and we should talk about Akedas Yitzchak, because we're going to read about Akedas Yitzchak on Sunday. And we're going to cite Akedas Yitzchak, Akedas Yitzchak, Yom Barach Mitzchak. I hope to have time to discuss that with you as well, maybe on Friday, a little bit. Okay, the second issue, okay, cultural transference, okay? If you are a humanist, and a humanist means you believe in human beings. You believe in Tzelem Elokim. You think favorably of people. You think that people by and large are built and crafted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu with virtue, with nobility, and with kindness. And I think to be a humanist in that tone is part of your Avodas Hashem, to believe in Tzelem Elokim, to believe that Hashem didn't just craft us like monkeys or rocks or trees, but Hashem invested in us. Tzelem Elokim, Vayipach Biyapav Nishmas Chayim. Then your basic assumption is that groups of human beings that develop culture and systems and mores, by and large, they're going to get it right. They're not idiots. It's like thousands of people doing things and it's all just stupidity. And therefore, when you see a culture that's different from yours, you'll basically assume, well, maybe if I understand it a little better, I'll understand. Again, I'm not necessarily saying that their fixed north will be. Maybe it's a culture of paganism, but internally there'll be logic. There'll be internal logic. People are going to live meaningful, healthy, balanced, responsible lives. It could be that the entire vector will be off. The entire system will be, we believe in Zeus and we believe in gods of ocean. But within that, they'll create a world in which they'll care for family, raise children, support one another. The orientation may be off. But internally, they're not just Aborigines, even Aborigines, running around without clothes. You could have cannibals, you could have murderers, you could have Vikings, but basically people... Now, we can believe that humanity could take a wrong turn. Humanity took a wrong turn for about 1,000 years. It was called the Dark Ages. And there was a lot of death and a lot of persecution. But even then, I imagine if you landed back in the Dark Ages, people just won't be wantonly slicing each other's heads off. Although there were large groups of people that were wantonly slicing people's heads off. By and large, you're average people. So all of a sudden, to look across the divide and find a culture that's different from you, and just assume, well, if it's different, I don't understand, then it must be internally flawed and ridiculous and absurd. Again, it's a cultural, it's not anachronism, because anachronism is when you go back to a different period in time, but it's similar to that. So let me give you an example, okay? I hear this very often. Oh, those Haredim, they get married after 3 or 4 dates. They must have terrible marriages. They must have terrible divorce rates. And then when you actually study it, it turns out it's just not true. Their divorce rates are pretty much similar to our divorce rates. And their index of happiness, again, that's hard to gauge, but you know, I have relatives and friends, my wife. I don't feel much difference. Now, the expectations may be different. Happiness is based on fulfilling expectations. So if your expectations are filled, then you're a happy person. So maybe your expectations are a little bit different in that world, or maybe the way you fall in love is different in that world than it is in your world. In our world, you fall in love and then you get married. To fall in love, you need to date for a while. In their world, they say, let's get married and we'll fall in love. And love is something you can achieve at. So to fall in love through marriage, you just need someone that you can imagine falling in love with. Right? Let's say I said, you have to fall in love and be in love. Let's say I made a challenge. In order to survive, I'm going to kill you all unless you fall in love over 2 weeks. But really fall in love. So you know you have to fall in love. So expectation will change. You have to reach a level that, so you pick who are the women you could fall in love with, and your criteria would be very different than, can I first fall in love and then make a decision to get married? Now, you grew up in our world, so that means you have to proceed based on the world you grew up in, because your wiring is such. So you have to follow your wiring. You can't get married if your wiring is one way. But be careful about misunderstanding cultures and not appreciating. If the basic premise is that people are good people, and the basic premise is that people are kind people, that tzelem elokim, they'll create societies and cultural norms that will be livable, sustainable, and by and large positive. They're not going to be just hoodlums and barbarians. Even more so when it comes to previous generations. There is a word, you can Google it, it's called generationism. It's a very, very dangerous perspective that has even greater resonance over the last 300 years because humanity has changed so dramatically. Science, reason, technology, revolutions, politics, economics. The basic aspect of generationism is that everything about contemporary modern generations is more advanced than previous generations. Rather than saying that we've made major advances, those advances have carried certain prices, and we've had certain disadvantages in every sphere, even in the sphere of politics, where by and large, we could claim that the political advances of democracy over feudalism or monarchy are severely lopsided. 80% of democracy is beneficial for humankind. But would it be so hard to draw a list of problems with democracy? I don't think it'd be too hard. Inefficiency, polarization, politicalization of health issues. If there were a king who said, this is what we're doing, it'd be very efficient, very quick, very rapid. Now, we're all happy there's democracy. We're all happy there's capitalism by and large, but are there dangers to capitalism? Of course there are. Wanton abuse, concentration of wealth within the hands of a few. So in every area, even the areas we've advanced, there are flaws, but certainly in other areas that are a lot more subtle, such as sexuality, marriage, and romance, one could discuss whether our world is better or our world is worse or our world is just different. People didn't marry for romance. People married, consolidate families, consolidate wealth, take care of women, take care of children, take care of daughters. Marriage was not romantically driven, by and large. You have exceptions. Now, we're a product of a world in which we've been taught to look for our soulmate and to invest romance to create that soulmate in that relationship. So please, don't marry a woman until you're romantically in love with her. Okay? Sometimes boys ask me, Rebbe, how do I know? I say, if you're asking me that question, don't marry her. They say, Rebbe, how do I know? I say, I'll tell you what, you really want an answer? Don't marry a woman until you have problems with Kavanah during Shemoneh Esrei. Until you can't have Kavanah during Shemoneh Esrei, please, the Rebbe, I already don't have Kavanah. Okay. Trust me, you'll know. Okay. If you need to, dial me up and Mirat Hashem where you're dating. I'll give you more graphic descriptions of how you know. But I think you know when you know. Okay? But they didn't marry that way. And part of romance is freeing sex from childbearing and freeing sex from the family context. And that has unleashed, as you know, a boatload of issues that I wish didn't exist in our world, from pornography, addiction, exploitation of women, hard exploitation of women, soft exploitation of women. As I'm sure, you know, I was working out yesterday, so let me just look at some of the highlights of the football. So I want to see how bad the Browns lost. I said, isn't it interesting that we can play football without cheerleaders? And I don't have to hide my eyes every 2 seconds. Like, why is that less pornographic? It's just a spectrum. It's just, you know, putting women's bodies on display for people to hoot at and enjoy as eye candy. Is that significantly different? It's just society has deemed that tolerable pornography as opposed to intolerable pornography. So do I dream of a world? Now, can we have both? Maybe we can. Maybe we can have a world in which we have romantic engagement, but it's so pure and simple that there's no exploitation. I don't know. But all I know is I don't view the world of sexuality and marriage that we live under as superior to the world they lived under. I view it as different. I view it as my world. I have a responsibility to live in that world because that's how I've been wired. I wish some of the baggage that comes with this world wouldn't exist. But I don't see that as superior. I just see it as different. So some areas I see as superior, but we have to be careful about the dangers. Some areas I see just as different. And this came to a fore over the summer, particularly in the United States, with the whole controversy about statues and about... And was George Washington an immoral person because he owned slaves? And maybe people who sold slaves were immoral. Although, again, they were I can't say they were moral monsters because it's hard for people to think in moral terms beyond their reality. And I'm sure your grandchildren and my grandchildren will look at our world and say, you were trapped in certain moral conventions that you just couldn't escape. And you did things that were certainly immoral to one another. Because that's the nature. You just change the paradigm and you free your mind to think in new terms. But someone that owned the slave, because that was a custom, he wasn't actually selling slaves, just owned the slave, because in that world, mass labor... Or in a world of pre-mechanization, you just needed mass labor to survive, and everyone accepted it. And now, slavery is very, very different because slavery was imposed. Marriages were not imposed. It may have been imposed upon the daughter, but society, right? I'm a father, so I'm a father of a daughter. So I feel to my daughter the same way I feel to a... I'm not a male. I'm a male who loves a female, loves my daughter as my female. So slavery was imposed on entire cultures, whereas... marriages and forced marriages and stepping in and maintaining the family was not imposed. I mean, if you were the Yavam today, you were also the father of a girl tomorrow who was the Yavama. So it's not like, oh my goodness, the males were dominating the society. If in theory Yavama was hurtful, it would be hurtful to me tomorrow to see my daughter have to go through Yavama, if in theory. And the answer was it wasn't hurtful. That was just the society they lived in. Now we're living in a new society, and of course we don't employ Yibam Chas V'Shalom, and my great uncle did Chalitza, we apply Chalitza across the board. So obviously we can find flexibility within the halachic system to make adjustments. But all of a sudden to travel back in time, not just across the boundary and think about other cultures you don't really know internally, but travel back in time when the world was totally different, it's just you should pause. This again, we haven't talked about Chazal yet. This could be a question of statues. You should pause before you say things that are just humiliating, not just because they're limited in your knowledge, but because you're applying from Euclidean geometry to non-Euclidean geometry, from one system to another system. And again, the assumption is within the system, they led moral lives, and probably lives that were... If you ask me, the moral index, I have to believe that 1700 or 700 was a better moral world than ours. It's just, I get that sense, respect for people, respect for the human condition, opening your home, lack of real crime, lack of... It just felt like a more wholesome world. Okay, we've lost some of that wholesomeness. Our world is more comfortable, but more morally challenging. And I think if you take a moment and ask yourself that question internally, honestly, do you feel like you grew up in a... You know, there's a lot of moral crusades, a lot of Black Lives Matter, and those are important moral crusades for us to be part of. But I found it jarring... but representative to see the Black Lives Matters juxtaposed against the looting. And again, there's no reason whatsoever to impugn the people who are legitimately protesting because of the looting. But the world allows for both. And not every person who gets up with a flag to wave a moral crusade is also living a moral life to their family and to their children. And to the so that if you're a social crusader for social justice, how are you at home and how are you in your community? Not how are you on Fifth Avenue waving flags, because it has to start at home. So I just want to introduce this subtlety and sophistication. Just don't speak about cultures you don't understand, about periods you don't understand. The final part of this puzzle is how we view the world of Chazal. And that is not just about statements of Chazal. Again, it could be against the Torah. How do you view HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon? But with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, many people have an easier and a more immediate answer. Well, it's the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not Basar V'dam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a divine, eternal will. We can't fully understand. Is that right? If Hashem told you to go back to Vienna with a gun in your hand, and you'd meet a person named Adolf Hitler walking down the street, and Hashem told you, pull the trigger on that person, so for us, that would seem like an immoral act, but if Hashem gives us the knowledge that we don't have, that would save hundreds and hundreds of millions of lives. So you can argue hypothetically, but if we're willing to open ourselves to sources of information that we can't access, all of a sudden the situation changes. And of course, with Amalek, we don't even know. I gave you a hypothetical with Hitler. Amalek, why does Hashem want to kill Amalek? In our limited world of human calculation, it doesn't stack up. But if you feel the only system that you live by is human calculation, I'm sad for you, by the way, because human calculation, as expanded as it has become, is still limited. But the baseline is to be human calculation. Certainly your feelings are based on human calculation. And your feelings, if I would be forced to kill Amalek, let's say, again, there's no mitzvah of Amalek today because we don't know, but let's say hypothetical, I do it crying and kicking and screaming. Just like Avram at that kid is crying and kicking and screaming because he's a human being and he can't make sense of this. So execution-wise, you submit to Hashem, but your values and your emotions shouldn't be abdicated, shouldn't be abandoned. Now, with Chazal, it's a little bit more tricky, okay? Because they were human beings, okay? But they were human beings in two major areas of difference than us as human beings. Two or three. Number one, their proximity to the Masorah was dramatically different from ours. Number two, their level of command of Torah was not just quantitatively different, but it's like learning an entirely different Torah. Trust me, I know this because I saw a Tana. Rav Lichtenstein learned like a Tana. He didn't have the command that they had, but I never saw anyone learn like Rav Lichtenstein. It wasn't just quantitatively he knew more. The only way I can describe it is taking a helicopter, going 20,000 feet up, and looking at the entire system of Shas like a bunch of Lego blocks and pulling a Lego block in. I never met anyone that learns like that. Most people learn, you read Rishonim, you give a svara. Some people, you learn a few sugyas, like Rav Moshe Lichtenstein can mimic Rishonim. How did Rishonim learn Shas? They didn't read Rishonim. They didn't have Rishonim. They read five sugyas and they developed it. I can't do that. I need to read Rishonim. I'm not smart enough to read five sugyas and be a Rishon. I am adept enough to read five sugyas, 20 Rishonim, and approximate what Achronim did. Not as good as them, but approximate their models. But I never met anyone that could be a Tana. Tanas didn't read Gemaras. They didn't have Gemaras. They just knew the pieces of Torah. And Rav Aaron wouldn't give a shiur on five sugyas. He'd give a shiur on concepts, and he'd pull a Mechilta, and he'd pull a Sefri, and he'd pull a Hava, he'd just be pulling pieces up, like minyas, up, and putting it together and develop an idea. That's how the Tanaim learned. So it wasn't just their proximity to the Masara as preservation of the Masara, but it was also their level of command, which was, if you know learning and you dig deep into their logic, it's just otherworldly. Finally, it wasn't just proximity to the Masara. Finally, they lived in greater proximity to the great shift in history. One of the great shifts in history happened with the closure of prophecy. The closure of prophecy is, I'll just put into general terms to you, about 450, beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. And with that closure of prophecy, the world shifts from a supernatural world, a world of supernatural information, a world of interaction with spirits, a world of interaction with angels. That was that world. And we're now the products of 3,000 years of the post-supernatural world and the emergence of science as our great tool. And thank God we have that tool. But it's not the only tool, as we're realizing. And when Hashem shut down that world at the end, beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, Hashem didn't just blow the whistle and say, okay, everyone out of the pool, the world's ended, no more supernaturalism. A supernatural environment still remained. So that's why our Tanayim had access, or some of the Amoraim had access to Sefer HaYetzirah. What would Rebbe do in Erev Shabbos? He'd make people. Okay, it's Erev Shabbos. You make the Chalas, I'll make the people. He took out a Sefer Yetzirah, and he baked people. We don't have Sefer Yetzirah. Or they interacted with Shadim. We don't have interactions with Shadim. Better or worse? I don't know. I don't have to solve those problems. No, it's different. I don't interact with Shadim. I solve it by... I don't interact with chickens and medical responses that are based on supernatural forces that I can marshal. I go to a doctor. better or worse? I don't know. You'll tell me one day. After we solve coronavirus, couldn't we have solved coronavirus with the third offspring of a second black chicken and the ashes of some birch tree? I don't know. I imagine they did. They weren't idiots. They weren't idiots. They solved their health issue as best they could. I imagine that our life expectancy is higher than theirs. So if our life expectancy is higher than theirs, mirastam, the medicine that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed us to discover through science and reason, is superior to their medicine. So were they limited by the medicine of the day? Of course they were. They weren't idiots. They were using medicine that maybe was more limited than ours, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't reveal scientific medicine until a later stage in history. But they were operating and maximizing medical treatment within the non-rational or maybe homeopathic and herbal levels available. So should you use herbal and homeopathic Chazal medicine today? Most people would say not, because we believe that Western science-based medicine has evolved. But because of those three statements, A, their proximity to the Masara. I'll make the statement number two. Number two, their command of Torah, and I'll add to that statement, I believe that at certain points in history, Hashem sends special people or special groups of people to preserve the Masara. The Vilna Gaon didn't just evolve because his parents scored high on their Russian LSATs. The Vilna Gaon was a malach sent by HaKadosh Baruch Hu because Torah needed to be rebooted. Torah was suffering, Torah was dwindling. The Vilna Gaon knew Shas at the age of three. That's not because he was so smart, he happened to be smart. You don't know Shas by the age of three because, you know, it's something Hashem creates. He sends people at certain times. I think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent the Lubavitcher Rebbe or the Baal Shem Tov because it was a movement of Hasidus that needed to be created. At certain points in time, Hashem intervenes, certainly in the history of Torah, in order to fulfill the promise, Ki lo tishakach mipi zaro. And I believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at this period, when the Beis HaMikdash was closing, when the period of prophecy was closing, it's around Hanukkah, Hashem says, let's create a generation, a 500-year period of a supernova. And there'll be people who will just be absolutely committed to Torah and will maintain it. Some could say this would happen in the yeshiva world pre-World War II to just create. That's already more social commentary. So it's not just that they happen to be very smart Rabbanim who happen to. I think there's providential, I think it's hashkacha. But because of their proximity and because of their command of Torah and because of their contact with this other world of information that we don't have anymore, and therefore please don't embarrass yourself by dismissing things you don't know about. It's like saying, I have one tool in my toolbox, and the only thing that exists are things that tool can decide. That's so. It's embarrassing if you'd say that. You have that tool. It's powerful. Use the tool. But people sometimes ask me about Kabbalah. Imagine if this entire universe were just one room in a building. And you can't leave that room. The entire universe, as broad as it is just a room. And there are other rooms, and they're laughing at you, and you think it's the only room. Not that it's laughing at you, but... So Kabbalah means we get information about rooms that now we choose in our world, by and large, not to really worry about those rooms. We focus. There's enough to deal with in our room. It's big enough. We have enough challenges. Let's, you know, stay in your room. Stay at home. Stay in your room. But to say it doesn't exist because you can't see it is that moral tinge that I can get to everything because I'm so smart, or humanity is, maybe it's personal, maybe it's humanity at large. That's what I'm trying to help you avoid. And because of that, we tend to treat Chazal a little bit differently than we would treat any other group of people that would have statements. We tend to treat Chazal based on the pasuk Lo Tasur Mikol Asher Yagid Lecha Yamin Smol, the famous Rashi Afilo Yamin Shu Smol Afilo Smol Shu Yamin, without describing what Chazal meant by this metaphor. Obviously, it's self-referential. Chazal are articulating it about themselves, but we tend to treat Chazal as these higher authorities whose Masara we submit to. And when we talk about them in ways that maybe they weren't like. When I talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik, I have a keen sense that he was made up of the same DNA that made me up, I'm composed of. He lived more or less in the same world. He operated under the same conditions. He was just 3,000 times greater than I'll ever dream of being. But when I talk about Chazal, I feel as if I'm talking, just like when I talk about the Avos. I'm talking about myself, a similar Badim, according to the Ramban. They were part human, not angel, but they operated in celestial spheres. They had access to celestial information. They triggered celestial events. With Chazal, I wouldn't call it celestial, but it was supernatural. It's very dead. It wasn't affecting things in heaven as much, but the resurrection and creation, they still had residual supernatural tools available. And that's why we're very, very careful about Chazal. And we're so careful about Chazal, this is a perfect year. Okay? Mirtz Hashem, we're all ready for Rosh Hashanah. We'll try to get ready. Please, please, please come to my shir tonight. I never beg you. I never plug it. This is a really important shir. And I'm going to talk a lot about the shofar. Shofar, 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 shofar. First day of Rosh Hashanah, no shofar. What happened? Chazal made a takana not to blow the shofar. Why? Because if you blow the shofar, you'll carry 4 amos and Rosh Hashanah Rabbim to consult with someone to blow the shofar. Okay, guys, that will never happen in 2020. Why will it never happen in 2020? A, because there are 1,000 experts in shul. You don't need to go to the one expert in town. And everyone will tell you they're an expert. How do I blow a shofar? Oh, I'll do it. Number two, 95% or higher of our locations have Erevs. So carry the shofar. Last week, I actually went up north to they call it Zimmer, like cottages and bungalows. And we got there in the Shkiach, like literally 45 minutes before Shabbos, we realized there's no Erev. So we called the Mashkiach, so he has no Erev. I said, how could you invite 19 people without an Erev? So we quickly gathered string and made this huge Erev, and it was makbid that it should be mahajim min a mahajim, mamish, two lechis, and a karal gabayim, each area we made an Erev. And there was one Erev that was less than 10 amos, I put an Erev there also, I didn't want to be somech on the Pesach Kula. So we made a beautiful Erev. But every town has an Erev today. But Chazal were operating in a different world, they made a takana. This takana no longer is relevant. Okay, now there are a lot of takanas that are no longer relevant we keep because we don't have the machinery. Okay, I'm sorry to speak so long-winded, but these are important things. I know much learning will get done today. Okay, when people have a harsh view of Yiddishkeit, you don't really, who's a hockey fan here? Any hockey fans? Okay, Joey, you're at Washington Capitol, it's still called the Capitals?
No, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh Penguins, okay. Yeah. You tell your friend about the Pittsburgh Penguins, okay. Say, I want you to come see this team, they're great. They knock the lights out. Okay, first mineral on the ice, Mario Lemieux, is he still playing? Gets a penalty. Send him to the box. So now it's 4-5. 2 minutes later, help me here.
You want someone from the 90s or you want someone from
the 90s? I don't
know. Okay. Well, does Jager work for you?
Okay, Jager. Jager gets someone to the box also. Okay, so now it's 3-5. And then the next time, the next guy gets thrown into the box.
It can't be 2-5.
It's 2-5. Yeah, it's illegal. Nope. Okay, but let's say it worked for you. Let's have you two. I guess in soccer you can throw people out. Okay, so now it's 8-11, 7-11. And then your friend says, this is the team you told me about. They're getting wiped. They're getting creamed. They're getting pasted. It's 14-0 in soccer. You say, well, they're playing shorthanded. This is not the real team. Yiddishkeit is playing shorthanded. We don't have a melech, we don't have a beistin, we don't have a navi, we don't have an ormiturman, we don't have a beis hamikdash. Thank God we have Torah. We're like, it's 1-20. You know what would happen in the days of Chazal if a husband dared refuse a get to his wife? Anyone? They would invite him to beistin. They would invite the woman to beistin, the iguna. They had an iguna room and a, I'll tell you the room in a moment, it's called a morgue. Then an iguna room for the woman to make. And then they had the man. They said, look, to the woman, start going on Tinder, try to find a day, because you can get married in about 5 minutes. And either you'll be a grusha, or you'll be an amada. It's not going to make a difference. Okay? You ready? Ready. You ready? Go. And they take the guy back and say, okay, I'm going to talk to you the way we talk in Brooklyn. Okay? Do you understand something? Do you want to divorce your wife? Do you understand me? Because if not, we're going to tune you up. And I don't mean Mozart, okay? We're going to tune you up. That's how we talk in Brooklyn, okay? Bada bing, bada boom, you're going. You're going either to the divorce room or to the morgue. Okay, you make your choice. We don't have that today. Sadly, people don't realize we don't have it today because it's illegal. Could you imagine, seriously, every day you wake up or every week you go to the Navi and the Navi looks at you and says, okay, Avi Balsam, why don't you do A, B, C, and D? That comes from up high. It's not a Musa Shmooz. You don't have to make any translations. For you, that's what the Vilna Gaon said. You sat with the Navi. Things would be pretty clear. Could you imagine if Chilul Shabbos led to Skila? I think we take Shabbos a little differently. Could you imagine if the rainfall, it's not just that our team is shorthanded, but the world is shorthanded. We don't have a cause and effect world anymore. Hanochi Aster Aster Panamim. Could you imagine? Every time you did a sin, something happened to you. You won't sin. So our world is so fallen, and sometimes you're so far fallen, you forget you're fallen. You think this is a perfect world. And so we're playing shorthanded, and You know what? You know what's going to happen when Mashiach comes? I promise you, this is going to happen. Mashiach's going to convene a Beis Din. He's going to say, what are the first four things we have to repeal? What would you say the first one is? Kinyos and Pesach.
Women not giving
aid. Well, that's Minatara. I'm saying, what are the first takanos? Because you can't repeal a takana. Okay. He's been waiting for that for 2 weeks. They're going to say blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, even if it falls on Shabbos, and take a lulav. Now, will HaKadosh Baruch Hu change parts of the Torah? I don't know. I can promise you, because takanas chachamim become less relevant or irrelevant, but our commitment to that masara means that until we have the machinery called a Beis Din, Gadol B'Chachmavin, you can't repeal. And this year, as it tells us in Rosh Hashanah, when you stand in Rosh Hashanah, I will be saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashem, I come to you, not b'schus HaShofar, because I'm not blowing today, I come to you b'schus my commitment to Chazal. And I'm not blowing the shofar today because I accept Chazal's authority. And I want you to take that in place of my shofar. The second day will come b'schus HaKedas Yitzchak. The first day will come b'schus Samchus Chazal. I'm so committed to Chazal that I'm dying to blow the shofar. I can't, because Chazal told me I can't. And until we have the Beis Din, we can't. Now you'll tell me, well, what about women's learning? Didn't Chazal make a takana that women shouldn't learn Torah Shebal Peh? Answer, they didn't make a takana. The Gemara says, Kol hamalamed es bito, Torah ki'ilu, it's a social commentary. Had the Mishnah said, Aser lelamed bito Torah, gzera shema, gzera, we'd burn down Migdalo? We'd have to shut it down? Seriously. They did not say usher. They said kol hamalami. Kol hamalami means, by the way, the world we live in, this is true, and therefore this is true, this is true. Once the world changes, we feel free to make those changes. If I make a gezera, I can't move. Can't move. Chazal made it to the takana. That's why our commitment to Chazal. And today, it's really one of the pivots of Yiddishkeit today, and it's suffering a lot. There's a lot of, why is it suffering? A lot of rabbis act very, very toxic. And once people lose trust in rabbis that live in 220, they lose trust in people and rabbis that live in 220 CE, you know, not to 2020, but 220 CE. So a lot of it is backloaded. Rabbis ruin Chazal's authority. Or sometimes we're just so contemporary and we believe so deeply in our world, we just can't imagine a different world operating in different circumstances. Okay? Obviously, not going to have too much here now, but I felt like it's just so important. I have 5 minutes, I want to answer your questions. We'll delay this year to some other point. But it's just so important because it touches on so many important ingredients of being a Ben Torah. Intellectual humility. Not to say things before you study. Appreciating other people. Knowing that they generally get it right. Again, the system could be tilted in a wrong direction, but within the system there's internal coherence. Pagans are tilted towards paganism. But pagans aren't barbarians that eat each other's blood. Pagans are people that raise their families and invite you into their homes and have whatever commerce and economies, and it's tilted to a system that's off. Until it gets to the Mabul, where there's a total collapse. It's possible to have a total collapse, but those are rare. And Hashem promises they won't happen again. Okay? Germany was a total collapse, not of the population, but of a large segment. It was a total moral collapse. So you have moments, but by and large, it's internal. I promise you, if you went to Iran now, and you live, if you lived a couple of days, you find moral people, and even within the Revolutionary Guards, even within, maybe the top fanatics that are cold-blooded murderers, you'll find people that raise their families and go to work and are kind and get stuck on. It's tilted towards a certain view of history that's bellicose and belligerent and murderous. But within those systems, there's internal coherence and internal morality. So be careful about how you view other cultures, and be careful how you view the past. It's really, I'll try to find, there's an article by Rabbi Lamb that I really enjoyed reading this summer when I took out this book to try to get a better sense of some of his articles on generationism. And he was really living at the cutting edge because in the 60s and 70s, this was very, very potent. Everything old is outdated, everything new is contemporary and evolutionary and idealized. And he really has some very, very nice phrases to address this. I'll try to send you this article. And then finally, it's really important. Now, within the statement of Chazal, there is some people feel that the way we view Chazal has to not just translate to halacha and moral statements, but they'll maybe adopt their medicine, or maybe if Chazal felt the world was flat, maybe we're wrong. And I don't think we have to get those. We can say their view of science was limited, their view of medicine was limited, but when it's moral, when it's halachic, and when it's statements, and when it, and marriage, and so summarize. Yes, when I read these things, they're off. but I don't get riled about it. I would never sell my daughter to marry her, trust me. I would never officiate at a Yibum. We'd never officiate at a Yibum. And if someone rapes a woman, he has to be punished. And again, even in the days of in Chazal, what happened to a rapist? Now, what does the Torah say happens to a rapist? Marries her. What really happened to a rapist? The Melech came in and threw him in jail until he died. A very, very important Drashas Haran. One of the Drashas Haran is there are two judicial systems. There's Beis Din that operates the halachic judicial system, and then the Melech does what he wants. So if he raped her, what we'd call statutory rape, because, you know, okay, so you lost your head, you got drunk, whatever you have to. But if it was a violent or aggressive or, again, I'm not excusing that, I'm just trying to create a difference. If it was a type of rape that revokes, the Melech would take him and put him into that morgue. I mean, the Melech had the right to kill you because you need to be able to make adjustments. So why does the halachic system not include them all? Okay, those are the questions we spoke about before. It was kind. So you're going to kill the rapist and the woman's going to be on the streets, literally on the streets starving to death. So the woman has the right to be married to that person, at least to be supported. And in those days, as crazy as it sounds to you, as crazy as our minds, I can't fathom being married to your rapist. As crazy as it sounds, the alternative of banging on the streets and being raped repeatedly every night is much worse, because that's probably what would have happened there. So these are not flawed ideas. They're ideas that don't make sense in our world. Just to end, okay? Just to remind you, every day you pray for the restoration of Yerushalayim. When Yerushalayim is restored, we're going to slice the throats of animals in the Beis HaMikdash, bow down to a king, and we're tefillin all day. So everything about your world will be different. Imagine how your world will be different if you were tefillin all day. It's going to be hard for me. You have a pair of basketball tefillin. Small little pair, be a little bobby pins. Okay, you were tefillin all day, and you'll be mocked with karbanos, except according to the Rambam, but 99.99999% of the Rishon disagree with the Rambam, and we'll have a king. So it just means that this is our world. Maximize it. Do the best we can in this world. Understand that it's imperfect, but it doesn't make a difference because you can't go back to a different world. So it's the only world we have. So you have to live within this world. But be careful about how you render positions about worlds and ideas that are not embedded in our little prison that we live in. Okay. 2 minutes of questions. Anyone? Comments? Please. This is a conversation starter. But okay. Yeah. One person's last name starts with B. One person's last name starts with L. Any L? I'm just picking letters of the alphabet. Okay. I'm closing my eyes. Someone with B, talk. I don't want to play favorites. B, a B to a person.
Okay. I'll be with very generous.
Generous, okay.
So, I see, it's something that, I found very frustrating for a very long time, so I really like that, you brought it up and it was answered, I think, in, a very delicate and, good way. My only question would be, it still doesn't sit well, the fact that, even, not even just on a basic meaning of the Torah, but that the fact that so many people struggle with the way that things are described in the Torah, to me is a problem that one rabbi in one yeshiva in Gush Etzion can explain it well, but if you go on all the major Orthodox platforms and try to read about it, you'll never find a good answer.
So,
and the fact that the language of the Torah just seems so...
So here's my answer to you, Jeremy. Here's my answer.
Shouldn't it be applicable to our world too? Shouldn't the language of the Torah?
So shouldn't we have more great Gush Etzion rabbis? guys, if there's a problem in this world, stop complaining about it. Clean it up. So yes, you know how many people. I'm gonna redirect. You know how many people's lives and religion have been ruined because they met the wrong rabbi at the wrong time. Not just about this, but at a funeral, insensitive, or at a bar mitzvah, or whatever. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of millions of Jews who are in the wilderness of religion because they just didn't have a rabbi to do it right. About many, many issues. So yes, that's a problem.
Shouldn't the language of the Torah appeal to our generation as well, just as much as it did to the generation?
I don't know the answer.
I don't know.
Part of me senses that we've spiraled so far that we can't even imagine. That's not. I'm happy that we view those things the way we view them, but we spiraled so far sexually that we can't even imagine an alternative. It's one thing about saying it's an alternative, but it's not ours. What you're saying is it's not an alternative. I can't even imagine the alternative. So that to me is our free fall. That we're so far removed, and we're so, just the things that we look at, and the way that we, and the celebrities that we celebrate, and the relationships that are based totally on egotistical sex or selfish sex. It's just so hard to imagine anything else. Part of it. But I can say I don't know. I'm allowed to say I don't know. You're less. It's an important answer to say you don't know. Rav Amital told us the most important answer to give yourself is you don't. You can say you don't know something. Guys, most important part of today's share is it's important in life to say I don't know. And if you hear your Rebbe saying I don't know, it's not the end of the line. You don't know certain things in life. So I don't know that answer. Okay, I'll stop the tape because I have to pick up my kid up.